Now, a new study shows ancient human relatives were walking across a Greek island 5.7 million years ago. Hominids, who are part of our family tree, weren't thought to be at the site of these footprints until millions of years later. Gemma Tarlak is a senior editor at Discover Magazine based in Waukesha. She joins us about once a month to talk about cool science news. Gemma, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, how big a deal is this study before we get into the details?
Well, I have to say this could be a very big deal. And the bit of hedging there, comes from the fact that this is not as certain as if, say, we found the actual fossil, the actual skeleton of a hominid. But, you know, this is a trace fossil. That's what they call fossilized trackways. And it's pretty enticing.
Okay, tell us about this footprint and where it is and what we know about when it is.
Okay, sure. And just a tiny bit of background. When you look at the evolution of hominins, and hominins are basically any primate that is more closely related to us than to apes and chimps. So hominins are all the primates that are kind of on our side of the human-chimp split. And the oldest known hominin in the fossil record right now, it's from Chad in Africa. It's called Sahelanthropus, and it's about 5.8 million years old, give or take. So this 5.7 million-year-old potential fossil trackway is almost as old as the oldest actual hominin fossil we have. And the fact that it's in Greece is kind of mind-blowing because we don't expect to find any hominins there for millions of years later, about 4 million years later. So all of a sudden, you've got this really early hominin that apparently was walking around in Greece, and what's even more incredible is the impression left by its foot, if that's what it is. Again, I have to hedge that, but the impression suggests a foot that was already fully developed for walking on two legs or being bipedal. So there are all kinds of really fascinating things, the age, the location, and just the advanced anatomy of what appears to be footprints.
Now, it's good to be clear here. This is not grandpa we're talking about. This is probably not a direct line ancestor of modern humans, right?
That's correct. That's correct. In fact, I spoke with one of the authors of the paper, and he said he wanted to be very clear that all evidence we have of every kind is that modern humans, you, me, every other modern human on the planet, we all evolved, our roots are in Africa. So he's not saying that, hey, we evolved in Europe, but it appears that there was at least one very early hominin, kind of a different branch of the family bush rather than the family tree, but one very early hominin was strolling around Europe way, way back.
And I gather there was some pushback in the scientific community. Why was that?
Oh, my goodness, yes. There was a lot. There was a lot of pushback, and it was from a lot of different perspectives, quite frankly. You know, human evolution is kind of a very special thing within paleontology. The field of paleoanthropology, a lot of researchers have invested a lot into their work, of course, but there's also this extra layer. In fact, the author I was speaking with called it a mythology about human evolution. You know, this is not just the story of a dinosaur or an extinct fish. This is our story. So people attach a lot of extra symbolism, and every new find really gets challenged. So that's one part of the puzzle. And then some other researchers are saying their data is looking pretty good. Their dating methods were very sound. We have no comments with that, but, you know, they didn't look at all the possible explanations for these footprints. They didn't look at all the possible animals already known to the fossil record that may have made these tracks. So a few researchers I've spoken with feel that maybe the team jumped to conclusions a little bit. And I put that question to the co-author I spoke with, and he said, you know, everybody take a breath. We have even more detailed analysis coming out in a couple months. So I'll reserve judgment, but it's huge if it turns out to be hominin footprints.
It seems like there's just this rash over the last couple of years, Gemma, of new data points in human evolution, hominin evolution. Why are we finding so much stuff now?
Well, you know, I think researchers are always finding new stuff, and they're always finding stuff that really challenges things we thought. And you know, that's how science advances. It's when you find something that is initially very controversial, and then other researchers come in and find evidence that supports what you found. But, you know, in this case, there are so many different ways now to test and to analyze and to look at whether it's a fossil or some ancient DNA or even a fossil trackway, that we can look at it in so many different ways, whether it's digital scanning, CT scanning, you know, sequencing, all these different ways that really helps researchers get beyond what you can just see with the naked eye or under a microscope. And I think that is creating a lot of new discoveries in a lot of new areas that, quite frankly, I think it makes it even more fascinating.
We're talking to Gemma Tarlak from Discover Magazine, looking at some of the coolest news from the world of science. Moving on, Gemma, new research on how people in the ancient Incan Empire communicated with each other. Now, they had this, it's called quipu, am I saying that right?
I think so, yeah.
These are these famous string things with knots. And I've seen things, I was at the Smithsonian, they had this amazing thing on the ancient Incan roads all through what's now Peru. And they had examples of these things. And what I thought, and I guess what people thought, was these were counting. You counted how many livestock you had with these. But they're way more than that, it looks like.
Oh, my goodness. They are so complex. And again, this is something that researchers are just getting into to really determine their complexity and what may be hidden in the lost language of the quipu. And just for readers who haven't seen them, who might have a little trouble visualizing, if you just picture this cord of a textile, you know, most of them are made of cotton, but some of them are made of animal hair and other things. You have this cord, and then from it are hanging all these other cords, and they're either different colors or different fibers, or they have all these different knots that are spaced differently, or maybe the knot is tied clockwise or counterclockwise. So there are all these kind of binary differences within the cords and pendants, and it turns out, yes, we've known for more than a century that that was kind of like a counting method to say, okay, I have 20 sheep, or I just sold 5 sheep, whatever. But it turns out that a couple of researchers think the way the knots are tied, the ply, which is the way the fiber is actually twisted into a thread, all of that is a binary code that could be male or female, high status or low status, sheep or goat. So it becomes this whole language hidden in the cords. And this one researcher thinks that she has uncovered potentially a phonetic code hidden in the quipu that actually, you know, could be read kind of like the kanji in Japanese. So it's really fascinating research, but when we think that the Inca Empire from the 15th and 16th centuries spread over 3,000 miles, had as many as 18 million people, and didn't have a written language, that's always been kind of a puzzle. How do they keep track of everything? How do they communicate? It turns out that it may have all been through the quipu.
And what kind of messages do these researchers think might have been hidden in these?
Well, you know, just like think of your email. You've got emails that are receipts for maybe something you ordered in an online company. You've also got emails that are messages to your friend, hey, when we're getting together this weekend. So pretty much anything that you could record in a written language could be recorded in quipu, if the latest research is right.
Yeah, I was going to say, this complex set of messages formed by very simple series of binary combinations, that sounds like something. This is kind of like a string computer, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I want to move on to one more science topic, the definition of animal domestication, like how humans domesticated dogs or how cats domesticated humans. We're changing, I guess, our definition of what animal domestication means. What's going on?
Yeah, you know, it's funny. About a year ago, a study came out offering a new and broader definition of animal domestication and domesticated animals, saying basically, over generations, it is a mutually beneficial relationship between two organisms, one organism influencing reproduction and care of another. And it was the first time that a researcher had proposed a definition of domestication that didn't have the word humans in it. And that's because we're finding more and more species, especially in the ant world, that actually domesticate plants and animals. There are ants that farm fungus and herd aphids. And there are all these relationships way beyond humans that turn out to qualify as domestication.
Huh. So, yeah, I would, if I thought animal domestication, I would instantly leap toward humans being involved in one end of that equation. So ants are doing it, too, and other species.
Yeah, yeah.
How does it work, though, when ants are domesticating, say, aphids?
Well, basically, they get a couple aphids, and instead of just nibbling on them, or different ants do different things with the aphids, but instead of, say, using them as a food source immediately, they keep them around, they keep them in conditions that are nice for making more aphids, and then, you know, when they need a meal, they go to it. They snack on their investment, shall we say.
And then I gather we're learning more about how we humans have domesticated other species. Things like, why do dogs have floppy ears and bigger eyes than wolves do?
Exactly. And this is, you know, it's not just dogs. It's throughout vertebrates that have been domesticated, whether they be, you know, chickens or goats or pigs or dogs or cats. They do have this suite of features that's long been called the domestication syndrome. And it's only been recently, in the last couple of years, that researchers have figured out that this so-called domestication syndrome actually is the result of a deficit in neural crest cells. And neural crest cells are these cells that form kind of along what becomes the spine in a vertebrate embryo. And as the embryo develops, these neural crest cells kind of march out throughout the body to affect all different kinds of functions, everything from if your ears are straight up or floppy to what color you are. And it turns out with domesticated animals, when they're still embryos, the neural crest cells move more slowly. That's the deficit, the neural crest cell deficit. So some of these cells never reach their impending their intended target. So they never impact, say, the color of an animal or whether its ears are floppy or erect. And that is actually why we end up with this domestication syndrome. It's super complex. I've massively oversimplified it here. But trust me, it's a very fascinating look at how this thing that Charles Darwin observed more than a century ago, really how the science behind this actually works.
We'll leave it there for now. Gemma, thanks as always.
My pleasure. Talk to you soon.
That's Gemma Tarlak, senior editor at Discover Magazine. Based in Waukesha, she joins us about once a month to share cool science news.